views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.
Welcome to Executives After Hours, real conversations with real leaders. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. I want to make you a promise that over the next 60 minutes, you will learn at a minimum two things. One, every leader and executive makes mistakes on the way to the top. And two, and more importantly, everyone has a unique story to tell. And that's what we do here on Executive After Hours. We sit down with leaders across a variety of industries, and we talk to them about their unique story. So welcome to the community, and stay tuned for today's episode on your Executives After Hours. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Executives After Hours. I am your host, Dr. James Kelly. And everyone, if you celebrate Easter, happy Easter to you. On today's episode of Executive Hours, I had the most raw, open, real conversation with a leader that you possibly could have. Today on the show, I had Miss Connie Fife. Miss Connie, as I like to call her, was the former CEO of Girl Scouts of America and is currently on multiple boards, a book author, and hosts her own podcast called Up or Out with Connie. And we both are on the same networks, can you believe it? C-Suite Radio, as well as Conscious Business Radio. You can also get my show on EngageMe.online. EngageMe is an online magazine that is all things employee engagement. It is done quite well, very interactive, so I'm sure you would enjoy all of it. And finally, one more big news to drop. I'm now officially on Thrive Global, which is an Arianna Huffington company. It's her spinoff of health and wellness. My podcast will be distributed there as well. So look me up on Thrive Global where you can get all sorts of content on wellness, psychology, health, whatever. It's all there. All right. So as always, please remember to leave a review on iTunes and subscribe to iTunes. I hope everyone has a wonderful week, had a wonderful weekend, and look out for my bonus episodes. All right. Take care, everyone. See you.
Well, you know, and like to be in the position of, I don't give a shit, right? Like,
yeah,
you know, like in some ways, you know, you're at where you're at in your career isn't, you do things that you want to do, not that you need to do.
Right. Yeah. And they're making this turn into a job. And it's like, I don't want a job. I do this because I don't want a job.
Yeah.
And so the board chair is a little upset. And I said to him, I said, and not to sound arrogant, but I said to him, I said, I don't know if you realize what I do.
Yeah.
I said, the only reason that I stepped in here was because you begged me to do this, because I was on the board before. And when the other person who the vice chair wanted this position, and then she couldn't take this position because they weren't offering health benefits and she needed the health care benefits. And I said, you know, I said, if she wants it, she could have it. Make sure my phone is off. I said, she could have it. So then this morning, and he's like, well, you do this, 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 and this is the board chair. And I said, I don't think that was the conversation at the board meeting on Friday. I said, and this is the reason why we need to have a board retreat, so board members know how to behave. I said, and you are acting inappropriately as the board chair for this organization.
You just basically gave him the smackdown and then the letter of resignation and dropped
that's
the mic.
That's what I did. I did a mic drop. So they're like, well, he's like, well, you have obligations, you know, for the next couple of months. I'm representing the organization at Nationals. And I said, and I will do that. I said, if you read the letter, I resign as of June 30th. I will fulfill my obligations. I will go to National. I'm speaking there. I said, and then I'm done.
Well, do you think that will be hard, though, if you're not behind them, like to go speak on behalf of them?
Oh, yeah, the state representative already called me. That's who I was on the phone with before you. He's like, what? What? You're doing what? I said, Gary, And he knows that I've been frustrated, and he's the one that begged me to come on. And he knew me from Girl Scouts. And I said, Gary, I said, I'm sorry. I said, I am not here for a job. I said, I don't know if these people realize that I'm the chair of $1 million organization and I'm here doing their grunt work. I said, nope, I'm done.
Yeah.
And like I said, the same thing. I didn't mean say that to sound arrogant. I said, but I don't think they realize what I do.
Yeah.
You know, this is not my business. You know, they're a client. I only stepped in to help them out.
A lesson of saying, you know, I think sometimes when you're in consulting or advising, it's hard to fire a client because you're always usually believing that you should be at their beck and call. But there's always a time where you've got to say, all right, well, that's the line, and be willing to walk away. So I have a question. So, like, you know, I actually am kind of curious where you're originally from. I know it's Pennsylvania, but where in Pennsylvania are you from?
I'm originally from Louisville, Kentucky.
Oh, well, I wasn't even close then. Jesus. I don't know why I thought Pennsylvania.
You're right, though, because then I went to Pennsylvania, and I was there in Pennsylvania through junior high school and high school, and then from there I went to with my husband, Washington, D.C., and then back to Maryland in Gaithersburg area, as well as at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And then back to the Northeast, where I became CEO of a local chamber, or director of a local chamber, and then I became CEO for Girl Scouts out of New York City.
So you basically have done my interview in about 35 seconds, so let me just back up a little bit here. So like, where did you grow up in Pennsylvania?
Scranton.
Joe Biden, Scranton.
That's right.
He's so proud of that.
Joe Biden.
You didn't know
Hillary's family's from there, too.
Oh, really?
She didn't grow up there, but her family's from there. Lake Sheridan, the local lake. Her grandmother died a couple of years ago. She was there.
So what was it like growing up in Scranton? In my mind, I have only been two things I know of Scranton is University of Scranton, so Catholicism.
And
in my mind, it's an armpit. So, and I don't think the second one is necessarily true, but in my head, that's what I think. You said it's not close? Okay, fair.
No, I said close.
No, I know what you said. I was kind of playing the opposite of that for the audience. So in case you offended somebody, I was trying to cover you a little bit on that one.
Scranton is it's a nice area to raise a family. It is a coal mining community. Scranton has a lot of old money. For an entrepreneur, it's really tough to break into that world if you're not part, as I say, if you're not part of the lucky sperm club.
Yeah, that's a great visual, by the way. I'm just like thinking about it.
And that's where I was director of the local chamber. And I was entrenched in the market. I knew people. But unless you're part of that club, it is really hard to break away. The mafia is still very strong in that part. Very,
really?
Very strong there.
So what was it like, though, was it like growing up in Scranton? Like, how many brothers and sisters did you have?
Now you're really getting into a complicated question.
Which is great.
I did not grow up in your traditional family, okay? I grew up with a woman I called my grandmother. And, okay, if we're going to go back a little bit. So I was born in Louisville, Kentucky. And I lived with my family there until I was about 4.5, 5. Very poor. We're from the Appalachian Mountains in Kentucky. And my mom had already moved on, and she was in Pennsylvania with a new husband. And then I was taken to Pennsylvania. But because I was not the real member of the family, as they say, I was sent to live with someone else. And that someone else I called my grandmother. And I lived with her until shortly right before I was 16. So growing up there for me wasn't Girl Scouts. It wasn't, you know, education. The irony of that. And I grew up to be the CEO of Girl Scouts. Who knew? But growing up, my role in the family growing up from, I mean, I remember back to the age of 8, 9, 10 years old, my role in the family was taking care of all my cousins that would come every day. So I would, when they would arrive in the morning, the house was cleaned every morning. I would make everybody's breakfast. I would make everybody's lunch, including their parents. I would take the kids to school, like all my cousins to school. And that's when we had half day kindergarten. I would have to come back home at lunchtime, swallow my food, make sure everybody was fed, go back to school for the afternoon, take other cousins back for the afternoon classes, and then come home and make dinner, clean the house.
How did you feel when, like, how did you feel having to do all of that at such a young age? Like, was it resentment?
I was bitter. Resentment. I didn't like people. I wasn't a nice person. I just wasn't. And then on top of that, my grandmother, we lived in an apartment, a high-rise apartment, and to pay the rent, I mean, it was the babysitting, but she was so heavy and so sick, so she couldn't move around. I mean, she basically just sat in her chair, and I did everything. So then at night and weekends, to make more money to pay for the rent, I would clean houses for the neighbors. I would do grocery shopping for neighbors, elderly. I would do babysitting nights and weekends. I had a bicycle and with a little basket on the front, and I would ride around the neighborhood and knocking on doors so I can make money to pay the rent. And of course, I had to hand everything over to do that. And then sometimes I would recruit. This is when I knew I was an entrepreneur. I would recruit some of my neighborhood friends to help me so I can get more clients. And then I would pay them something. And then, of course, have the rest for the household. So
you were a hustler. Like, you were a hustler from like, how old were you? Like, 16, 15, 16?
No, I was 10.
But, I mean, like, you were just busting your ass, yes, from a super young age. Like, how do you... Like, I don't know if you can at that time, but how do you mentally, psychologically come to terms with that later on even? You know what I mean? There's this disconnect of, because you have children, right? So you have children, you know that the way you were raised, maybe not at the time, but that's not a normal upbringing. So how do you connect the two and make peace with
it? It took me a while to make peace with it. It really did. I spent a lot of money on therapy.
Yeah, I could imagine, which is justified.
I spent a lot of money on therapy in my 20s. I mean, like I said, 8 years old, 10 years old, 12 years old.
Yeah.
That was my life. That's what I did. But at the time, it was, this is what you have to do. There's no choices, no questions asked, and it was definitely survival. And then occasionally, I would get to go visit my family, who I was told was my family. So occasionally I would go to visit them. And then as I started getting older, then it was, the guilt would be laid on me. Why do you have to leave? Like, you know, you have your grandmother here that you have to take care of. What is she going to do when you're gone? Because that she was sickly. So part of my job in the middle of the night was to make, and I slept in her room, to make sure that she had her blood pressure medicine, to make sure she had her diabetes medicine. So school wasn't important for me. If I would have come home with a B on my report card, it was punishment, because then I was working too hard in my schoolwork and I wasn't working hard enough to take care of the family.
Well,
so
that's not,
it's
a messed
definitely
up message,
reverse psychology. You know? So yeah, I was screwed like from the get go.
So like when you, like, so was it your mom's mom? Was it your dad's mom? Was it just a woman that they all knew really well?
Okay, good question. Another crazy question. It turns out, and I didn't know this until 5 years ago. I just found this out. Living there, I guess education wasn't important. I was being told when I would turn 16, I was going to quit school. The carrot was, instead of riding my bicycle, she was going to let me get a car that I would have paid for myself. And she would let me get a car, and then I could quit school, and then I could go work at the sewing factory down the street. I cried. I mean, I prayed. I did everything I could to say, please, you know, dear God, I don't want to quit school. Although, my grades sucked, but I didn't put any effort into it. but school was still, it started getting more important to me. Well, it turned out, and this sounds horrible, she died a month before my 16th birthday. And I've never cried. I call it a gift. After she died, then through the rest of high school, I did live with my parents for a bit of time, but that didn't work out very well.
You had no rules. Like, your rules were take care of someone else.
I had none. Yeah, so that was my outlet. I used to get in trouble all the time. So then now I had to go live with somebody who said, okay, you have rules. You still have to work, and you have to give us your full paycheck. Oh, and by the way, you're in bed like at 9 o'clock at night. And I was like, oh. Yes, there was like no way.
So wait, going back to your grandma though. So like, I was gonna ask that question. Like, there was probably this sense of guilt, but relief at the same time. Like, you felt guilty because you felt relieved.
Yes, I had huge guilt over that. I had huge guilt that I didn't get along with my family. And to answer your question, the father that I'm referring to turned out, I learned 5 years ago, he was not my father. And this was, oh yeah, because that is, it's a crazy story. And then, and then the woman who I lived with, who I call grandmother, sometimes mother, was his mother. So when they sent me to Pennsylvania, again, back in the 60s, it was like, oh, she's a bastard child. We don't want people to know that I was born out of wedlock to my mother. And so initially I was sent with my real dad for a few years. And then when he couldn't afford me anymore, I had three different last names before I was 5 years old. So talk about a personality disorder.
So what did that teach you? Like, what's the outcome of that? Well, so there's probably two parts of that, right? So there's the post-therapy, pre-therapy. So in the pre-therapy, what did that do?
The pre-therapy. I tried to turn myself around in high school. Education became very important. So this was, I had 2 years to catch up, my junior year, my senior year.
Why did it become important? Like, but why did that become so important all of a sudden? Because you could have easily just been like, you know what? Here's my path. I'm going to go work at the sewing factory. And that's my life. Like, what? There had been something inside you that said, like, I'm not going that way.
And that was that internal drive, and I never understood what that drive was. It was like, as soon as she was gone, as soon as I told my family, like, I'm out of here. I mean, I still lived in Scranton. I mean, I stayed in the neighborhood. I just bounced from different people. Mm-hmm. And I just put it in my mind that the only way I was going to get out of that shithole was to get an education. I mean, that's mm-hmm. what it did for me. So I became a cheerleader. I was a cheerleader. And then I actually ended up, I was inducted into the National Honor Society.
So it's kind of like gave you confidence, right? Like, so
it did, because it was like, I know I could do this. Like, I need to work hard. I need to catch up for those 2 years. But what happened after that? Yeah, I wasn't a very good person for a while. Yeah.
But that's probably the buildup of resentment, right? So like the output of who you are is the input of what you got, and you never got love. You never got intimacy. Yeah. People just took from you. Right?
Yes.
Like, give me your money, give me your time, give me your effort. And there was never the reciprocal on the other side. And if you do that to someone, there's going to be a negative consequence, and which you're going to clearly tell me right now what that negative consequence was.
There was no love growing up. So I finished high school. I wanted to go off to college, but that, because only imagine, they didn't think high school was important. So why would they think college was important?
Yeah.
And I got the, you know, you're a woman, you don't need the work, go work in the sewing factory, you're not going to college. And I mean, I really didn't have the financial means to do it on my own. And to get a loan, it just, at that point, I was just, okay, I can't, you know, I just can't do that either. So I did not go work in the sewing factory though. I will have to say I did not. I got a job in downtown Scranton at the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, working in the office. And I thought I was like, woohoo! I was like over the top. Like, I am working walking in an office.
So what you basically did is you made one step removed from working in the actual garment factory. You worked in the office.
I worked in the office. Yeah.
So technically you proved everybody right. You weren't going to go work in the factory.
That's right.
In the garment factory. I like it. Stick it to them. I like it. But, all right.
So I made a difference.
Yeah.
And it was there. So I was already dating my ex-husband.
Yeah.
But so we were already dating. And then and this was before computers were around. And they said, we want to send you to the University of Scranton for computer classes to learn how to work a computer. Well, I was on that. I was like, I'm going to college. It was a 6-week computer course, but I was going to college and finished that, learn how to work a computer.
Yeah.
And I decided that, okay, I could do this. And I signed up for school for computer programming and science and math. So I did that, and same time I had got married, and I was 19 when I got married and went to school. Well, it turns out that my ex-husband gave me that same lecture. There was no need for you to go to college.
So I think this is fascinating, right? You have these people who are supposed to be the most important people to you, at least theoretically, and they keep telling you no. Right.
Yes,
they keep telling you. And I guess what I'm trying to uncover and figure out is, why did you just keep saying yes? Like, or basically saying, fuck you, I'm going to do it my way. Like, what, like, everything around you says you shouldn't do that. Right. Like, it would be so easy and justifiable just to give up. So
yes.
What kept you going?
Well, I even to him, I was like, no. So we stayed married for 5 years. I had 2 children with him, and we stayed married for 5 years. My son was 3 months old when I walked out.
So you were 24, yeah. 25, 24.
Yes. Yes.
That actually sounds like my mom, by the way. So my mom grew up in this very Catholic family in Toronto.
Okay.
And married a Jewish man. So
okay.
Right off the bat, her family's like, what are you doing? And they had 2 kids by 24. The mom had 2 kids,
yeah.
That's right. Yeah. And he walked out on her. So like, it's interesting to see, it's like, what did you do, right?
Continued school. I actually would take my kids to class with me. At the University of Scranton, they would go to class with me. And I mean, other students, like those important classes, I mean, they'd go to the library and other students would hang out, you know, they'd hang out there. And so I did school. I got a job at HarperCollins Publishing. I got a job,
yeah.
customer service. And so I was doing that, doing school, having the kids. And I also, my family had a restaurant, the Donkey Cafe, and I would work there a couple nights a week too for money. And then this is when I started going, this is when I started getting exhausted from being beat up so much. So my early, after that, sex, drugs, and rock and roll just became part of my life. Mm-hmm. And I quit school. And that's who I was for a couple of years. And that's the biggest, I still get choked up over it because my kids were so young at that time, and I turned around to do to them what was happening to me. I wasn't there for them for those couple of years. They lived with me. That drive, that spark finally came back to me and said, what the hell are you doing? And
I'm not saying the behavior was okay, but the behavior is justified, meaning you just were doing what you knew.
It was what I knew. Mm-hmm.
You know, I think the miracle of the thing, which is what you're probably about to lead to, is that something in you clicked and said, I'm going to repeat this pattern again.
Yeah.
If I don't change tracks.
Right. If I don't change. And it was actually, because then I moved from HarperCollins to International Salt at that point, and I got into a really good position there. And it was actually my boss, because I was coming in the next morning after being up all night. I was sleeping on my desk. But I'm here. I said I dated a lot. Like I said, I drank a lot. I did drugs. And she came over to me, and I thought I was getting fired. And she said, you know what? She said, you really need to get it together. And she said, you have, you know, when you are on, she goes, you are super. I got promoted to community relations for the company. I managed 32 customer service reps. And so she said, she goes, you got to get it together. So she has suggested I go to this group, which was called BE, Beginning Experience. So I was like, all right, I'll go check it out. That was a pivotal moment for me. It was the life-changing moment for me. And I thank her for that. Her name is Mary Olszewski. You know, definitely thank her, you know, for introducing me, because she said to me, she goes, because I was in your shoes.
A little Leonard Skinner right in the middle. That is awesome.
And that was my theme song when I was in my 20s. That was like Leonard Skinner. You got it, baby.
That was awesome.
I told you that there's people following me. There's people like they remind me, honey, this is what you're trying.
But I was gonna say, you know, as human beings, we have maybe two to three major pivotal life moments.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And each one, in my opinion, and I'm one person, in each one of those, you always have choices.
Right.
And what is awesome is that you had someone looking out for you saying you could be a rock star if you just do this. Take care of yourself, you know, which is a lesson in life, right? Take care of yourself first.
You need to take care of other people. Right. Because I couldn't take care of my kids the way I should have because I wasn't taking care of myself. Mm-hmm. You know, it just, you know, wasn't happening. And so that was one of the pivotal moments in my life. And it was, I mean, literally it was overnight. I said, okay, I'm not drinking anymore. I'm going to stop having sex with anybody. And, you know, stop dating, you know, no more drugs, no nothing. And I stayed that way for 11 years.
Wow. And what was the output of that? That's amazing, by the way. That's fantastic.
So
what was the output of that?
What had happened, so in my 20s, so everything that had happened when I was younger got very strong for me in my 20s, and that's why I wasn't coping. Because a lot of the sexual abuse I had as a child, the physical abuse I had as a child, so that became very strong to me in my 20s.
And the emotional abuse, too. I mean, all of
it. And the emotional, and I think part of it was, again, I was getting it from my ex-husband, and I was constantly feeling like I was suffocating, and that people were holding me back, and it was a constant, you can't, you can't, you can't. And like every time I would take a step, and I was exhausted. I just couldn't do it anymore. And that's when I just threw my hands in the air and started down the path that I did. But there was this drive in me. Like I said, almost that there was always somebody around me saying, okay, you could do this. Pick yourself up, you know, get out of the gutter. And so I went to therapy, spent a lot of money in therapy. And then I became a therapist. And I started learning and understanding people. Because the other thing that was happening with me, I thought I was losing my mind, which I think I did a long time ago, but I would have dreams of other people. I would have visions of horses. I would just have thoughts of other people around me because I didn't know what had taken place with me between the ages of birth to 4.5 years old. No one ever talked to me about it. And that's what was like in the back of my head. So I also did dream study. I did reincarnation study. And so that's why I went down the path of going back to school. I ended up getting, at that point, yeah, it was all about understanding the psyche of people and why we behave the way we do. And at that time, I was trying to figure out why I was behaving the way I was.
Yeah, totally.
Because I had such guilt and, again, these thoughts of people. I'm like, where the hell is this coming from? Like, I must be, something is wrong with me. Yeah. So then for 11 years, I did that. I worked at the salt company. I became the community director, just kept working my way up because I thought, okay, if I can't understand who I am on a personal level, I'm going to focus on my career. And I'm going to focus on spending time with my kids. And so
while you're doing all that, though, I imagine you either still are or it's a work in progress, but coming to terms with what you went through, because at this point you're in your late 20s, early 30s,
right?
You know, and 11 years, so you're in your late 30s at this point. You're focused on your kids. They're probably teens.
That's 36. My son was 11, and my daughter was 13 when I met my current husband. And you know, and of course, I was like, no, I was like, no. I don't want to date anybody, no. Because to me, that was like death. Going near somebody. I was like, no, I didn't want that. Yeah. And I had said,
you must have been petrified of like intimacy and honesty
I didn't trust anybody.
Yeah.
You know,
how did he earn your trust?
It was really cute, actually. So I was counseling and I was doing some work through the Diocese of Scranton and through the single, separated, widowed group, BE, Beginning Experience. So I was still associated with them. And he had gone to them because he himself was going through a divorce. And he had called, I missed a whole step. My girlfriend at the time thought I was ready to start dating, and she put me in a singles ad. And I didn't even know it. And I started getting phone calls from people. I'm like, what? And
who put my phone number on a bathroom wall? Who did that? Who put it there?
Lisa, like, what the hell? And she's like, it's time you start dating. And because it was New Year's Eve and I was home alone and she came and spent it with me because she felt bad for me. And I'm like, I'm good. I'm good. Give me my old movies. And, you know, I'm good. I'm good with this now. And the one thing I learned was along the way going through that therapy, one of the most important things that I learned was that there's a difference of being alone and being lonely. That was, again, another pivotal learning. So then I had to learn that it's, you know, being lonely or being alone with yourself. So that was, so come New Year's Eve, I was like, totally cool. But she puts my name in. So he was one of them that called. And we started having this conversation, and he's telling me he's going through a divorce. And I'm like, okay, I don't want to talk to you. And hung up.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah.
Because I imagine as a single woman, that's probably like the one thing a guy who is trying to meet you shouldn't say, I'm going through a divorce.
No. And then that's when I'm like, well, you know, I'm a counselor for this group. And so we started having these conversations and we spoke for almost 6 months before I would meet him. And then he finally, when we finally agreed to meet, we're meeting on Super Bowl Sunday. And I was like, he wants to meet on Super Bowl Sunday, a sports drinking day, of which my ex-husband would be on top of that. And I was like, okay, I could give him a shot.
Yeah. Priorities. Yeah.
Right. And so we did. And we met, and then we didn't talk or date or anything for over 2 years after that.
How much of that was you getting in your own way?
All of the above. And then he called me. Could he go out to dinner with me now?
So, well, if anything, that guy's persistent. I got to tell you.
And we finally went out to dinner. And you know what was really cute? So, and I had just built my house. And my brother lived next door. I built a small apartment on it.
And what were you doing at this point? What was your career?
I was at Axel Salt. the International Salt Company. It was Axel Salt now at this time. So I was with them like all this whole time, like the 11 years I stayed with them. But what was really cute with my husband, with Jeff, so he pulls up and, you know, I'm in my new house. I'm only in there a couple of weeks. And I'm looking out the window and I could see him sitting in the car. I'm like, what the hell is he doing? And I finally say yes, and like, you know, and then he finally comes in, and I'm like, what are you doing? And he said, well, I didn't see your car, so I, you know, and our date was 7 o'clock, so I was waiting until 7 o'clock. I figured you were out. Well, I had hit a deer the week before. My car was at the. So I just thought it was cute, and then he thanked me for going out with them, and I was like, "Oh, I gotta thank you. That's an So it was like a 2-year process of, you know, him thanking me. We'll be married 20 years this.
Oh, that's awesome.
New Year's Eve, I made it 20 years.
That's, you know, I mean, from where you've come from, I think that's first of all, not even where you come from. That's amazing for anybody, but like from where you've come from, I think it adds to it. So, Connie, what I want to do, because I want to be conscious of your time, is I have a little segment called Fast Five. And after Fast Five, I kind of want to talk about quickly the back half of your career, but more about what you're doing now and the books you have coming up. I was doing some quick research. I know you're working on a book on corporate, basically, happiness and engagement of the sort. And we can talk about that as well. So are you ready to play my Fast Five?
I'm ready.
Question one. What was your first job ever?
I was cleaning houses.
Yeah. That was kind of obvious since you said it earlier, but I still have to ask it.
That's okay.
All right.
Okay.
Question two. What animal best represents your management style?
I've been called a queen bee.
Okay. Now, please elaborate.
Now, let me explain that. When I was doing all of that research, and then I started moving up in my job, and they had me do a handwriting analysis, and they came back and said, I compared me to an animal, that I was a queen bee. And I was like, oh, okay, I like that. I'm typically a take charge person. Like, I got it. But the downside, there is a downside. What does a queen bee do? You know what a queen bee does?
I believe a queen bee kills people.
Yes.
Right?
It attracts people, sucks them in, and then kills them. And then kills them.
So you're saying that you are full of honey and vinegar at the same time, really.
You got it. I will get people to do something. And when I look back, and that's kind of who I am, like especially dating guys, I would get them to do what I want to do, and then they would do it. I would say goodbye.
Goodbye, see you.
Yes.
Brutal, Connie.
Yes.
Brutal.
So I've worked on that to try to not be so brutal, but I know it still comes out.
There's probably a time and need for that.
Yes.
All right. Yes. Question three. What advice would you give your 25-year-old self, which could be kind of interesting?
I've thought about that question a lot, and the advice that I would give to myself is don't listen to other people. Do what I want to do, which was finish my education at the time. By the way, I have finished. I have a double master's degree. Master's in public administration, one in business administration, a minor in finance and marketing. So I went to the total extreme. I wanted it all. But that is my advice. Don't listen to other people. Do what you want to do. And you'll probably make mistakes along the way, but that's okay. It's okay.
I was thinking about the education thing. And so I can only speak from my perspective. But I would imagine it's similar. So I have a PhD. I have two masters. Mm-hmm. I have an undergrad degree. I've spent way too much money on education, hands down. But in retrospect, I did it for the wrong reason. I did it to try to earn people's respect. And I thought by getting those degrees, people that I perceived as important to me would treat me differently. And that did not happen for me whatsoever. And I don't know, like when you were doing it and going through it and going back, Were you doing it for yourself to prove a point that you can do it to other people? Or were you doing it simply just to learn for you?
Looking back, I did it to prove to other people that, again, because I was, like you said, for those first 20 some years, I let other people control my life. And then when I did it, it was to prove that to them, I could do this. I don't need your approval. However, what it did for me, because I actually never finished it until I left Girl Scouts 11 years ago. When I was a CEO for Girl Scouts, I only had my associate's degree. And when they did not, when they hired someone else, of course, I was devastated after Girl Scouts because I loved, loved, loved what I did there. And it was helping young girls and some of them in situations like I was in. So one of the reasons they said that they didn't keep me was because I didn't have a fancy degree. So I was like, all right, I'm going to fix you. And, you know, here we go again.
Yeah. Let me finish with Fast Five before we get too sidetracked.
Sure,
so
sure.
Question four, at your funeral, right? when you're pushing up daisies, what do you want people to say about you?
No, what I would want people to say is that, I mean, I really achieved, I really worked hard at not only myself, and that's why my tagline is to be unstoppable together, because I want to help other people on their journey, and I don't want them to ever stop. Don't ever stop, because if you stop and you give up hope, I mean, you're not going to enjoy life. And that was the one thing I learned, and that's what I hope people get, that I was here, I gave back, I helped and I supported other people, and I live life to the fullest because I enjoy what I do and I enjoy having fun.
I mean, it's, you know, I think that's a really, really fantastic the way you phrase that, from the standpoint of, I just taking again my own personal experience, there are times where I really want to just stop. Yesterday I was just overwhelmed and I was just like, I need to get off this fucking train for a while. Like I was just overwhelmed, too much going on. Kind of going back to what you said, it's that internal dialogue that you have with yourself when you say, am I going to get off this train or am I going to stay on this train? And then how do you know when to get off it and when to stay on it? Mm-hmm. Right? Like that's the other part of the question.
Right.
But I truly believe in, and I think I've come to this in the last probably 3 or 4 years, that if you truly believe in something and you think you're doing it right, then do it. And just to use my podcast as an example, I know I'm killing myself by having hour-long podcasts that I publish. I'm fully aware of that. All the research tells you that.
Yeah.
But like, I believe in what I do and I believe in the format that I do it in. And I think that if I tried to do what you do on your podcast in the half hour, it would do a disservice to what you and I have done in this last hour of dialogue to chop it up.
Yes.
But it does kill my, it does kill me. Like I get it, but I'm just passionate about the way I do this. And so anyhow,
well, I totally I started my show as an hour show and it was live and I was doing it myself and making sure the guests were there because, I mean, if you have guests that show up for a live show, what do you do? Then you have to talk to your club for an hour. And sometimes that's not exactly fun. Like how many times do you talk about yourself for an hour? So like you said, though, you have to decide what it is that you want. And I mean, you said part of it early on, you need to pick what lane you're on. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. And if podcasting is helping with the lane that you're on, fabulous, beautiful. But you also have to learn, and I know early on for me, it was really difficult to choose and say, okay, I can't do that. But I got my three-legged stool. And that stool has to serve everything that's in the core of what I do. And the core of what I do is serving women leaders, women in the executive, in the C-suite. Mm-hmm. That's what I do. And so everything that I do in that three-legged stool has to support that. So that's what's in my lane, just doing that. And it took me a while to figure that out. It did. And then that three-legged stool, okay, so what am I doing to support it? Podcasting does support it. Writing my books do support it. Doing my webinars and my blogs, everything that I do supports that because my blogs is writing to them, to that individual. Mm-hmm. Now, for the example is, so when I was at Girl Scouts, and of course, especially back in the Northeast, they had the natural gas boom going on.
Yeah.
And I was getting a lot of money from them in terms of sponsorships and donations and so forth. And while I was at Girl Scouts, they would ask me to come speak at a town hall meeting on their behalf. And I said, I can't. You know, I'm sorry. Appreciate all the money you give us. But at the same time, I really have to stay neutral on, you know, on what you're doing. And so I would, you know, a few times I did go and speak, but only to thank them for the donations that they gave us, mm-hmm. you know, but I still would keep it very neutral. After I left them, they called me and asked if I would, for big dollars, if I would have been their spokesperson. Do you know how tempting that was?
Sure, just low-hanging fruit.
Oh, it was low-hanging fruit. Yeah. I mean, you know, what they were paying me was my salary times three, you know, being the CEO of Girl Scouts. And I was like, oh, yeah. And then, I mean, I struggled with it. And my business coach at the time, he was in Nashville and I was in Pennsylvania. I said to my husband, because we were going to Florida on vacation that week, I said, we're going to drive and we're going to go through Nashville before we get to Florida.
Yeah.
I went to see Dan. I got to Dan. I was only in his office 3 minutes tops. And he's like, you know, I told him my dilemma and he looked at me, he goes, is that on your three-legged stool? And I went, no. He goes, well, then there's your answer.
Yeah.
And so I had to walk away from it because it didn't fit. Now, granted, I have taken on jobs or clients that really didn't fit. Like I do have one right now that falls into the realm of nonprofit management. Mm-hmm. That's really not in my lane. And the only reason that I took it was because I was on their board of directors and they begged me. And, you know, and again, they're paying me well. And they're asking me now to renew my contract. And I told them no. I mean, you know, I did it for that time. I had to say no.
But I think that the three-legged stool thing is what I always go back to. Because I have, I think as an individual, and I don't have a lot of sounding boards, I have a very strong sense of what I'm trying to accomplish, which is why, you know, the side business that I have here, which is, it's all around health and wellness. So corporate health and wellness, I have about, I don't know, 7 partnerships with companies in the US where I represent them out here in the Middle East, working with large firms, but it doesn't really fit with my long-term goals. You know, to me, it's low hanging fruit. It's easy to get out there. It's easy to make a name.
Yeah.
But, you know, so it's anyhow, not to delve into that. I need to finish Fast Five because we still have one more question left to go.
Just to add to that.
Yeah.
So you're building your name and if podcasting is what you want to do, find a way to dovetail that into your podcasting. I mean, it doesn't mean that you can't have other businesses. I mean, I have a real estate business as well, but that's separate. You know, what I'm doing. So it doesn't mean you can't have that, but just be mindful of your time and what you're doing so that you're not scattered. You know, you're not all over the place.
All right, listen, we got to move on. All right, question 5, last question. This will be a quick one.
All right.
What is your guilty pleasure?
The thing I already told you that.
I'm not sure which one actually, so there could be more than one.
my guilty pleasure right now, I mean, yeah, that was one. Not for a while. My guilty pleasure right now, oh my gosh.
How about what is your favorite Girl Scout cookie? Which one?
Well, I was gonna say I'm a good girl now, so that's why I don't have any. Thin Mints.
So
I guess that's one because right now it's cookie time.
Well, thank you for doing the longest Fast Five ever. I appreciate it.
I guess the guilty pleasure is I don't know when to stop talking.
Yeah. All right. So I just really quick, because you've been so awesome with your time, and it is going on 11:30 my time at night, and I have four kids, and I will be up at 6 a.m. So just talk to me about, you know, you've written four books, and you have your fifth you're working on now. Right. Is that right? Did I get that right? Okay.
Got it.
And, you know, what is the impetus of you trying to write this new book about employee engagement and happiness? Because that's kind of like a very it topic right now.
It's what I call emotional engagement. I know I talk about the happiness a little bit because, like I said, it is the, you know, the it right now about employees. You know, they want to work in a happy environment. Mm-hmm. But it really comes down to not just happy and a happy environment. What do you need to do to get your employees to emotionally engage, whether you're in a corporation, whether you're in an entrepreneurial business, you know, a small business, you need to get people to engage. And how that came about, and I, my book manager had asked me, suggested I go down this because I do talk about that in my leadership programs, is that like when I was running nonprofit organizations, we had record years. We had our girl membership from the, I mean, even from the U.S. Chamber and the dollars that we were raising and the lobbying efforts that we were doing. Every organization I was at, we always had record years, record sales. And so the question came back to me, how did I get people to do things? Because we talk about, what's the other one besides emotional intelligence? So we talk about emotional intelligence. That's not what I'm talking about, because you can hire people that are brainiacs. You can hire people that are super smart, like they did with Girl Scouts, but they couldn't connect with the people and they didn't know what the people wanted. So for example, at Girl Scouts, when I knew that the realignment was happening, you know, we had a year to put this together. I was leading the charge for it and, you know, being the project manager. So now I had a team that were working around me and I didn't want them to run out the door, especially my key people. And I went back to the board and I had asked for some funding that I could give them bonuses to keep them on. I went back to my team and offered them bonuses and they all declined the bonuses. And they're like, they all declined the bonus.
That's great.
Yes. And, you know, and I said, what is it that you want? So I started meeting with them individually. Like the one, for example, said she goes, she was taking care of her mom. And she said, I want every Friday afternoon off to get a massage. I was like, that's it? She's like, yes. She said, because she was so stressed out with, you know, Girl Scouts and taking care of mom. And Friday afternoon was her only time that she can get to herself. So I said, done. And I'm going to pay for your massage. You know? And then I sent her to the school because she, you know, was really good at graphic artists. Got them resume training, you know, get them each of their resume. You know, we talked about etiquette and how to interview. And because everybody had to reapply for their positions. So then when the board came to me and they were offering me a financial stay bonus, I had to turn it down too, because yeah. You know, the rest of my team did, so I had to turn it down. So the question always was, how did I always, whatever organization I was in, have record years from sales to growth? And it was that emotional connection with them, finding out exactly what it is that they want. And it's not always money. And, you know, especially, you know, when you're in a nonprofit organization, you know, because we don't always have a lot of money to throw at people. Yeah. But it was that, you know, just that team building and connecting and working together and letting them be heard. Because the one challenge we had with Girl Scouts, we had this group of renegade volunteers that were just so against it. So I was traveling the country with bodyguards. The Girl Scouts, I was traveling with bodyguards. They were just upset. I mean, it was changed and the organization didn't. So for a whole year, I was traveling like 7 days a week, every single day, holding town hall meetings, talking about the benefits and why this was happening and, you know, the economies of scale and it was better for the girls. And at the same time, knowing that I was probably not going to have a job. And so, you know, it was a really good dog and pony show. And so when it came to the end, all it was they wanted to be heard. They wanted their voice to be heard. And that's why I was holding these town hall meetings and saying, let me hear, you know, your concern. They would beat me up. But I'm like, let me hear from you. So when we got to the end, the delegates still had the vote to pass the realignment to happen, although we were being directed by the board of directors saying that this had to happen. So when the vote finally took place, the vote passed like I don't know, we had like 2,000 ladies. So it was like 90% or 94% to 6% that voted against it. And it was that group that gave me such a hard time that gave me a standing ovation. And I mean,
well,
and
I was
going
to say, though, like, let's just kind of go full circle on the whole entire conversation. It would seem to me that, you know, when you talk about the idea of emotional connection, emotional engagement, it almost all predicates back to when you were a child and like wanting to connect with people and the ability of when you have the ability to do it and control that infrastructure of connection, you thrive on that as an adult. And to do that, to me, at least, that's one of the tenets that I have and something that I'm writing about being an authentic leader is being able to relate to people. And one of the biggest ways you relate, and I think that's kind of one of the sticks of my podcast, is that I share stories about my life too and how vulnerable I've been. And when you do that, there's a trust that's automatically built with the people around you because you're a human being as well.
Right. Right. It's that authenticity. And that is what I talk about in leadership, because, you know, so often we get into leadership positions, and I know I'm guilty of it. You know, I didn't want people to see that big wart on my nose. And, you know, if I had to walk into a country club, I was like, I don't belong here. And, you know, it's that imposter syndrome as well that we have that, you know, if people only knew like who I really am and what I really did, and you know, why would they respect me? But when you allow that authenticity, I mean, you don't have to spill your guts and, you know, say.
Sure. Yeah. There's a line, though.
Right. Yeah, yeah. There is a line. But when you allow that authenticity to come across, that's when people are able to relate to you. And when I finally accepted that for myself and, you know, shared that big lie that I was holding all of those years, and then again 5 years ago finding out the truth about my family and why things happened the way they did, the guilt, although I worked on it all these years, I mean, I still had a strong hold on that guilt. And when I found out, like 5 years ago, when I let that go, it was like a pivotal point in my life where everything changed. Everything I'm able to, I like people now.
Good for you.
Yeah.
You're a recovering people hater. So I appreciate that.
And what you see now would never be me before. Like I said, I didn't like people. It would be like, like Miss Grumpy Pants and, what do you want? You know, very not trusting. And so I had to learn. That was one of my learnings, and to like, people are okay. And we need to work together. And again, that's why I be unstoppable together. And, you know, it was always be unstoppable, but it was like, we're missing a piece, and the pieces, we need to do this together. So, you know, the be unstoppable together, and it just resonates with people, and they, and, you know, they really understand what that, you know, what that means.
So I have my final question I ask everybody, because I'm always just curious. Connie, how do you, for where you're at right now, how do you define happiness?
My happiness came when my son and I are close. My daughter and I always had our challenges. My happiness really came last year when I spent time with my daughter. And we spent a couple weeks together. We did drink a lot of wine, and we went, you know, we cried a lot. And we also found peace with each other as well. And that truly gave me happiness. So my happiness is my family.
And I just want to say, you know, thank you for your time, your energy, your willingness to be open and have this conversation, and stopping by Executive After Hours. And I was thrilled.
It's been great. I really enjoy this. You get me to open up and talk about things that I don't do often.
Well, I think that's a good thing, so I appreciate that.
Yes, well, thank you.